we are entering into a new phase of the book of 1 Samuel. And remember that 1 and 2 Samuel are originally one book of Samuel. In the Hebrew Bible, this is one volume. But when the Old Testament books were translated into Greek in the 2 centuries prior to the time of Jesus, because Hebrew does not use vowel characters and the Greek alphabet does, many of those books became significantly longer and in some cases had to be broken apart into two. And that's the case with the books of Samuel. So we have them as two books, but it's really one story. And in the book of 1 Samuel, as we have it, we see three main sections. We see the time prior to the monarchy, where Samuel is the primary character in chapters 1 through 8. And then we see the appearance of Saul as he is identified and coronated, beginning in chapter 9 and really climaxing in chapter 12. And then several chapters concerning his reign before he is finally rejected by God in chapter 15. And then we see the identification and coronation of David, or at least the anointing of David. He's not formally coronated until the first part of 2 Samuel. And David comes on the scene in chapter 16, and the rest of the book really focuses upon him. But the latter part of this book, the second half, as it were, that focuses upon David, could itself be divided up into a couple of different sections. In chapters 16, 17, and 18, we see David in his glory, kind of David on the rise. But then David enters into what we typically refer to as his fugitive period. And this was a time of some years where he is on the run. Saul is trying to find him in order to kill him. And that is going to really occupy the rest of 1 Samuel. So that transition is happening here as we come into chapter 18. And really chapters 18, 19, and 20 are the transition from David's ascendance to his expulsion from the court of Saul. And finally, in chapter 21, he will be in the wilderness until Saul dies. Let's start by just reading some of the text. Obviously, we won't read all three chapters here at the outset. Chapter 18 of 1 Samuel. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Let's just pause there for a minute. Because of the timing, I'm going to have to insert some of the themes that I want to address at the end of the study. As I'm going to intersperse it through the text as we go, because I'm not sure that we're going to get through all three chapters. So some of these themes are going to make more sense when you've got all three chapters put together, but I'm going to go ahead and introduce some of them as we read. So in the previous chapter, Saul is lined up with his army in battle against the Philistines, but there's nobody fighting. And you remember why that was? Goliath, the Philistine champion, this giant, is coming out every morning for 40 days saying, "Give me a man." Right? "Give me a man that we may fight." And the outcome of that battle, that champion's contest, that duel, will decide the war. And of course, Saul and all of his men are paralyzed with fear. And you see very clearly the antithesis in chapter 17 between fear and faith. And we talked a lot about that 2 weeks ago. Now, as soon as that episode is over, as soon as that battle has concluded and Israel has carried the day because David, by the grace of God, has killed the giant, as soon as that concludes, we find ourselves in chapter 18. David never goes home. If you recall, back in chapter 16 and 17, David had served intermittently in the court of Saul as a musician. Right? He had come because Saul was troubled by this time by an evil spirit that had been sent by Yahweh, sent by the Lord. And it was the source of some of Saul's depression and moodiness and even, as we will see, violence very shortly. And David had been brought in as a musician to kind of soothe the beast. But now David never goes home. David is put into full-time employ in the court of Saul, but not just in his court as a musician. He is employed as a military commander. I mean, he's a young man, but he has won the rank of an officer on the field of battle, he has shown leadership surpassing any other commander in the army of Israel. I mean, what commander was there who was saying, I will go, I will fight? None of them. It was this kid. This untested warrior, at least in terms of human military battles, right? He says he has experience with God, though, supporting him when he faced lions and bears. And so David has won the rank of an officer. He is put immediately into the army of Saul and is given the garments, the badges, if you will, of that rank. Verse 5, Saul sets him over the men of war. And this is good in the sight of all the people and in the sight of Saul's servants. Now, one of the things to watch for is the ascendance of David, the approval and praise of David, and the envy of Saul. Because there's going to be a strong correlation between the two. There's something else I want you to notice even more importantly here at the beginning of chapter 18. Notice again verse 1. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. It's really unfortunate that this passage is now read in the light of homosexual relationships. That's not really anything new. It's been that way for some decades. But our current conditioning, our current Western conditioning, causes people to read this and say, this is just an abnormal sort of love between men to be anything other than a romantic relationship. Now, I want to say a couple of things about this that might offend a few people. So I want to just say it gently, but I'm going to say it nonetheless. I think that is quite a commentary on how broken our society's perspectives on relationships really are, right? That we don't see close, intimate relationships as being possible outside of romantic interest. And that is all kinds of messed up. It really is. We live in a society where even within heterosexual romantic relationships, our society suggests to us that your spouse should be your best friend. This is where I get offensive, okay? That's perfectly fine if your spouse is your best friend. I love my wife. We are very good friends. But you will search in vain for that teaching in the Bible, that your spouse should be your best friend, and that something is deficient in your marriage if your spouse is not your best friend. That's not the way the Bible talks about marriage at all. It's perfectly fine if you find that kind of intimate friendship with your spouse. But that's not the only kind of intimate friendship that the Bible teaches us to expect. In fact, Jonathan and David are going to have a relationship that David will say later surpasses any relationship he's ever had with a woman. That he will say, we are closer. Your love as a brother was better to me than the love that I ever had from a wife. Now, part of that may be he's got a lot of wives. And it's hard to develop the kind of relational intimacy in a polygamous context that you can in a monogamous one. And I don't want to discount that factor. But what I want to suggest to you is that even historically, just in more recent history than 3,000 years ago, societies, even Western societies, understood this, that there was a special type of relationship between a man and a woman who are joined together in marriage that is a different type of relationship than what either of them may have with other members of the same sex. And that's not an unhealthy thing. That's not a bad thing. In fact, this is a beautiful thing. This is not portrayed as a romantic relationship at all. In fact, it is explicitly portrayed as a covenantal relationship. Verse 3, Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. He cut a covenant with David. That's what the text says. Now, I don't know if they go through the formal covenant-making ceremony of cutting beasts in half, cutting animals, and walking between the pieces and saying, thus shall it be done to me if I am unfaithful to my oath. It seems at least possible that they formally inaugurate this covenant based on what is said in verse 4. But what I want to suggest to you is that this is a covenant friendship. It's not a romantic relationship. It's a friendship that goes beyond just the shared interests that might bring us together with people that we went to school with, or people that we were in the military with, went to war with. or that we shared together in our careers. That can be a special kind of brotherhood. Let me tell you something. You cannot have intimacy in relationship with people outside of the covenant like you can with people inside it. If you live in covenant relationship with the Lord, you will find that you cannot have the kind of intimate relationships with unbelievers that you are capable of having with believers. And this is only possible between people who have this common relationship with God. That's why you see the relationship between David and Jonathan and not David and Saul. That's an important difference. I think we need more relationships like this. I think we need relationships like this in the church. I think we need to use Paul's language, older women who are teaching younger women, older men who are teaching and modeling the way of Christ for younger men. By the way, Jonathan would be a good bit older than David here. And yet there is a brotherhood. There is a brotherhood. There is an intimacy. There is a covenantal relationship that transcends any differences between them, including the differences that ought to have put them on opposite sides. Notice verse 4. Jonathan stripped himself of his robe that was on him. Now, don't imagine he's stripping all of his clothes off. This is the outer garment that's being described here. But he takes off his robe and he gives it to David, as well as his armor, his sword, his bow, and his belt. Now, you and I may read that and say, well, that's interesting. That's nice, I guess. No, that's astounding. Because what Jonathan just did is, for all intents and purposes, relinquish the rights as prince of Israel. There is even extra biblical evidence to support this, that when a prince was disowned or relinquished his privileges within the monarchy, he was to leave his robe, this symbol of his office, when he went. These are signs of his power. These are signs of his position within the kingdom. I don't know how much Jonathan understands at this point about David's future. Later, it's going to be evident that he knows David is the next king. I don't know if he understands that right now. But whether he does or he doesn't, his actions are at least typological of what's coming. The crown prince just took off all of the garments that are associated with being the heir to the throne and gave them to the man who has been secretly anointed by God to be the next king of Israel. You think that's a coincidence? I don't think so. And this is Jonathan's attitude. He is absolutely unselfish. He loves David like he loves himself. He wants success for David no matter what it means for him. His attitude is like what we would hear in the mouth of John the Baptist. He must increase, I must decrease. Right? He is not interested in what his future may hold. He is interested in what the future holds for David. And that covenant is going to be of crucial importance in chapters 18, 19, and 20, which is why I'm mentioning it here at the outset, since I'm not sure we'll get to the end of the section tonight. Verse 6. As they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, "Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s." Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom?" And Saul eyed David from that day on. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall." But David evaded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because Yahweh was with him, but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David had success in all his undertakings, for Yahweh was with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them. They're coming home. This would not have been just the next day. This would have been after some days, because you'll remember that after the defeat of Goliath, the Israelites have the upper hand and they press that advantage. They pursue the Philistines some distance. So this could have been several weeks later. But however long it is, they are coming back from this part of the campaign. They are returning to, for all intents and purposes, at this point in Israel's history, the capital city. And the women are coming out singing and celebrating the victory, and word has already spread about what this young man has been doing. Not only on the field of battle with Goliath, but also in the subsequent mop-up operations with the army. And they are attributing to Saul, first, a victory over thousands, but then also to the real hero of the battle, they are attributing the victory over 10,000s. Now, that's obviously some poetic hyperbole, right? I mean, I doubt that David at this point in his life has killed tens of thousands of Philistines. It's poetic hyperbole that's appropriate to the moment. Here's where you begin to see very clearly the difference that a worldview makes and the difference that a heart that is transformed by grace makes. Because how does Saul hear that praise? He hears it with envy. He hears it in bitterness. He hears it in anger. A heart that is not transformed by grace is going to always view the success of another as a threat to their own. And Saul immediately identifies David as a threat to him personally. We need to think about this for a second. You remember the 10th commandment? You shall not covet what? Anything that is your neighbor's. Anything that is your neighbor's. Not his spouse, not his servants, not his home, not his donkeys. I can't remember the last time I coveted someone's donkeys, but or anything that is your neighbor's. Right? That commandment gets to the heart, and it points us all the way back to the first commandment, which is what? You shall have no other gods before me. Do you know where covetousness comes from? It comes from a heart that believes that I am entitled. I have rights, I have expectations, and I am entitled to good things. I am entitled to be healthy, wealthy, and wise. I'm entitled to be happy and honored and highly esteemed. No. That is the root that produces covetousness, and it is nothing but a form of idolatry. And here again, there is no coincidence. Verse 8, what does Saul say? What more can he have but the kingdom? Does Saul know that David has been anointed as the next king over Israel? No, he doesn't. But here's the ironic thing that's going to happen multiple times in Samuel Kings. Sometimes unregenerate people have profound insights that go far beyond their ability to know. You're going to see this, by the way, in the Gospel of John, where Caiaphas, the chief priest, who is orchestrating the campaign to discredit and ultimately to destroy Jesus, he says, isn't it better for one man to give his life for the nation and for the rest to be saved? He doesn't know what he is saying. He does not understand that he is speaking prophetically beyond his own power or piety. And Saul here is in the similar way. He's speaking prophetically without even being conscious of it. What more can David have except the kingdom? What do you think God's going to give him? He's going to give him the kingdom, right? And this is the middle of the end for Saul. We've already seen the beginning. This is now accelerating it. He eyes David with jealousy from that day on. Be careful when you start to see that developing within your heart. Be careful when you start to see that kind of jealousy and envy. What does that have to do with you, Jesus would say to Peter, you follow me, right? It's born of an idolatrous heart. The next day, verse 10, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul. We talked about this several weeks ago. This would be a demon of some kind, an evil spirit. And you say, how can an evil spirit come from God to torment Saul? In the same way that we see in 1 Kings chapter 22, that the Lord allows an evil spirit to deceive Ahab to go up to Ramoth-Gilead so that he might die there. In the same way that the Lord allows Satan to torment and trouble Job, God has a good purpose in this, even as Satan has an evil purpose. In this case, their interests align, even though they seek different outcomes. This evil spirit is allowed by God to torment Saul, and it drives him into madness. Notice verse 10, he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre. He had a spear in his hand and he hurls it at David, wanting to pin him to the wall. Twice, notice verse 11. Now this is an interpretive clue, by the way. One of the oddities in these three chapters that we're looking at tonight is that David does not seem to immediately appreciate how much danger he's in. And you'd say, wow, for a warrior, he seems a little naive, or he seems awfully generous in terms of his attitude towards Saul. Why is that? I mean, if somebody throws a spear at me, I'm not likely to sit back down in the room with them the same day, right? But David did. Why? Almost certainly because this would have been attributed to his madness, not to malice. But you've been in a situation like this, probably. You've been with somebody who's just out of their head. Maybe they're on drugs, maybe they're drunk, maybe they've got pain medicine in them, maybe for whatever reason, they're just out of their mind. They're crazy. And you're sitting there, you're in a position of danger. They could pick something up and throw it at you. Hopefully they don't have a spear close at hand. David is there with a therapeutic purpose. He's there to play music to calm this madness. I don't think that he recognizes that Saul is wanting to kill him. That Saul sees him personally as a threat. I'm assuming that David and probably the other servants in the court at this point simply attribute this to the madness that has overtaken Saul. And I also believe that that's going to explain Jonathan's naivete as these chapters unfold. Jonathan is not going to appear to recognize that his father has deliberate malice toward David. And it's only when it is absolutely undeniable that Jonathan finally admits to David, you can't stay, you've got to go. I think it's the madness that is used as an excuse. But notice that we have insight through the narrator, right? The inspired narrator here. He tells us what's going on in Saul's heart. Verse 12, Saul was afraid of David. Why? Because God was with David and he wasn't with Saul. This is important. What is it that makes Saul, in his unregenerate rage, fearful? It's that David has the presence of God. He has the blessing of God. And that frightens Saul. I interact with a lot of people who would say, perhaps, they don't believe in God, or they don't believe in my God. But the truth is, they know that God is real. They just hate him, and they're afraid of him. They are afraid of the implications of that God being real and being true. And they are, in the words of Paul in Romans chapter 1, suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. They're trying by means of their sin to press down, hold down that truth so that it is out of sight, out of mind, and they can't. There is fear in their hearts because they know fundamentally that there is a God. And Saul knows that that God is with David and is not with him.
There's a lot of suffering when we talked about in the New Testament that the believer is suffering.
Yes.
But a great deal of that suffering comes from without, the closest. It comes from the world around us.
Absolutely.
Especially in many cases, those closest.
That's exactly right. The people that are closest to us have the greatest ability to hurt us. Yeah. And we must, through many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God. A great deal of that is going to be the opposition that we experience in the world. Paul says in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 12, that all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. So this is not negotiable for a Christian, right? Not everybody's going to throw a spear at you, but if you have the blessing of God in your life, you are going to be feared and hated and opposed by those who don't, especially as they perceive you as a threat. So verse 13, Saul realizes that David is far too popular to just do away with him, but he doesn't want him in his court. He removes him from his presence, makes him a commander of 1,000. That means that he's going to be out away on campaigns, away from the presence of Saul for a time. He goes out and comes in before the people, and he has great success in all of that. Verse 14, for the Lord is with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. If someone else's success makes you afraid, that might be a little time for a heart checkup. If someone else's success makes you jealous, might be time for a heart checkup. These are not healthy indicators of a good relationship with the Lord. Verse 17, the plot thickens. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my eldest daughter, Merab. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight Yahweh's battles." For Saul thought, "Let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." And David said to Saul, "Who am I, and who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel the Meholathite for a wife. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, "Let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, "You shall now be my son-in-law." And Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David in private and say, 'Behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law.'" And Saul's servants spoke those words in the ears of David. And David said, "Does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation?" And the servants of Saul told him, "Thus and so did David speak." Then Saul said, "Thus you shall say to David, 'The king desires no bride price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemies.'" Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. And when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time had expired, David arose and went along with his men and killed 200 of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter Michal for a wife. But when Saul saw and knew that Yahweh was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines came out to battle, and as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed. Now, do you see the repeated refrain here? How many times does the text refer to David's being loved, David being honored, David being highly regarded by almost everyone except the king? Except the king, who, ironically, is the one who is benefiting the most from David's success. Do you realize this? All of David's success on the battlefield ultimately benefits who? It benefits Saul. It secures his kingdom. It obtains victory over his enemies. It enriches his coffers, right? It expands his sphere of influence. David is blessing Saul, and yet David is hated and viewed with suspicion as a result of it. So if you remember back in chapter 17, one of the things that was promised to whoever went out and fought Goliath is that he would receive the king's daughter's hand in marriage. And so now Saul realizes, "I'm going to have to follow through on that. I'm going to have to fulfill that promise." And so he says, "Here is Merab, my oldest daughter, and I'm going to give her to you for a wife." It's an incredible honor, marrying into the royal family, which, by the way, would put David in a position potentially to be able to claim the throne. Even though he would not be the biological heir, that would be Jonathan, he would nevertheless have a claim to the throne as part of the royal family. And with the popularity that he has, that has to be making Saul nervous as well. Now, the text doesn't explain why Saul does this or exactly how, but at the last minute, at the time that Merab should have been given to David, she's instead given to someone else. And it seems plausible that Saul does that in order to dishonor or embarrass David. Maybe it's Saul that gets cold feet. He's just afraid of putting David into an even greater position of privilege. Whatever his intentions, it cannot be a friendly act toward David. And yet, what do you see in the second half of the chapter? The whole time this is being discussed, first about Merab and then about Michal, you see Saul's hostility toward David. And what do you see from David? His humility. I mean, who am I? My father's clan? I'm a poor man. I don't have any reputation. It's like, are you kidding me? You know, every young boy in Israel at this point has a David the Giant Killer poster on his wall, right? I mean, he is a man of considerable reputation at this point. And yet, in his own mind, does he perceive Saul as a threat? Doesn't seem like it. Do you see this kind of simple, humble innocence? Yeah, he's still a shepherd. He's still very much this young man who is content to spend his days out in the fields with the sheep. He's not seeking great things for himself. Great things have been thrust upon him, but he does not regard himself as worthy of this kind of an honor. And yet, Saul's daughter Michal loves him. Everybody loves David in this chapter, except Saul. Saul's other daughter, Michal, loves David. And when this is reported to Saul, he says, okay, maybe there is a way to play this to my advantage. David does not see himself as worthy of this honor, and David does not have the physical or financial resources to be able to pay the bride price that would normally be associated with marrying the princess. And so Saul tells David, I don't want any money from you, son. I just want 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Now, you realize that to take a Philistine's foreskin, you're going to have to kill him, right? He's not going to just offer to let you do that while he's alive. They were uncircumcised. This is a way of counting coup. It's taking a trophy from an enemy dead. And if you think that is barbaric, talk to me after class. I'll tell you some other stories, right? This is actually fairly tame in terms of ancient Near Eastern warfare. This is a very common practice, right? You take trophies from the dead. You give me 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Now, what is Saul thinking? Well, the text tells us. Saul is thinking that David will fall by the hands of the Philistines, verse 25. He is trying to set David up. He says, don't let me do this. I don't want to get blood on my hand. Does this sound familiar, by the way? I mean, it sounds remarkably similar to a story that we're going to encounter in 2 Samuel chapter 11. But you can look at that later. And so David is pleased. David is excited. Before the time had expired, verse 27, he goes with his men. He kills 200 men of the Philistines. I mean, this is, you know, really, Michal, I really love you. You know, I think you're worth 200 Philistine lives, right? And he brings the full number back to the king. And Saul, of course, then has to give Michal to him. Verse 28, when Saul saw and knew that the Yahweh was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, he was even more afraid of David, and so Saul was David's enemy continually. But again, David does not appear to perceive that. Let's try to roll through chapter 19 quickly. And Saul spoke to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David, and Jonathan said to David, told David, Saul, my father seeks to kill you. Therefore, be on your guard in the morning. Stay in a secret place and hide yourself, and I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak to my father about you. And if I learn anything, I will tell you. And Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have brought good to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck down the Philistine. And Yahweh worked a great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause? And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan. Saul swore, as Yahweh lives, he shall not be put to death. And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan reported to him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. And there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a great blow so that they fled before him. Then a harmful spirit from Yahweh came upon Saul as he sat in his house with a spear in his hand, and David was playing the lyre. And Saul sought to pin David to the wall with a spear, but he eluded Saul so that he stuck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, if you do not escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed. So Michal let David down through the window, and he fled away and escaped. Michal took an image and laid it on the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair at its head and covered it with the clothes. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he is sick. Then Saul sent the messengers to see David, saying, bring him up to me in the bed that I may kill him. And when the messengers came in, behold, the image was in the bed with a pillow of goat's hair at its head. Saul said to Michal, why have you deceived me thus and let my enemy go so that he has escaped? And Michal answered Saul, he said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you? Now David fled and escaped, and he came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and lived at Naoth. And it was told Saul, behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah. Then Saul sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing his head over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. And Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. Then he himself went to Ramah and came to the great well that is in Sekhu. And he asked, "Where are Samuel and David?" And one said, "Behold, they are at Naoth in Ramah." And he went there to Naoth in Ramah. And the Spirit of God came upon him also. And as he went, he prophesied until he came to Naoth in Ramah. And he too, pay attention, and he too stripped off his clothes. And he too prophesied before Samuel and lay naked all that day and all that night. Thus it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? That's the part I wanted to get to tonight. So you have three main episodes here. One where Jonathan saves David's life, one where Michael saves David's life, and one where the Holy Spirit saves David's life. And one of the points that I want you to be seeing throughout this is just what we've been seeing in the Gospel of John. David's life, I mean, hangs in the balance. It hangs by a thread. Saul has thrown a spear at David three times. And Saul's a big guy. And he's a great warrior. And David ought to be dead. Saul is doing everything within his power to kill David right now. And it's about to get much worse, by the way. This is not the end. This is just the beginning of the hostility. And David cannot die. Not because David is so smart or strong or swift, but because God's Spirit is protecting him. David's going to be the next king of Israel. And even though at times David has seemed a little naive in the last chapter, and even though right now Jonathan still seems not to understand how serious the threat is, we'll see that more clearly next week in chapter 20. Despite all of that, God's Spirit is not going to allow David to be harmed, because God's purpose for David is going to be accomplished. And it doesn't matter if Jesus is in the temple and all of his enemies are standing around him with rocks in their hands. He's going to get away. How is he going to get away? Is he going to pull some kind of ninja move? You know, and no, he's going to get away, because he's not going to be taken until the hour and day that God the Father has appointed. And the same thing here. You need to recognize the absolute meticulous sovereignty of God in the lives of his people. And you need to see the parallels between David and Christ in this regard. Okay? Now, these three stories, just very quickly. At the beginning of chapter 19 is the first time that Saul actually opens up to his cabinet, to his advisors, his counselors, and all of the other people involved in his court, that he actually wants to kill Saul, or kill David, excuse me. If you go back to chapter 18, you'll notice that even though he tries to kill David three different times, he doesn't admit to it. He doesn't own up to it. The two times with the spear, they just assume he's crazy, he's having a bad day, you know how he gets, right? He just doesn't even know what he's doing. He's just liable to throw anything at the wall. It's just unfortunate that David nearly got pinned to the wall with that spear. And with regard to the campaign against the Philistines, it doesn't appear to be a setup. It's obviously an odd request, but it's not as though Saul paid a hitman to go and kill him. At the beginning of chapter 19, he tells his advisors, "I want David dead." And this is the first indication to Jonathan that David actually is in danger, that Saul, his father, has malice toward his covenant brother, toward David. And so Jonathan tells David, "You go out and you hide in the field. I'm going to see what I can do." And he goes and he appeals to Saul. Now, this is one of the oddities. Saul's attitude is very intermittent, right? This spirit that's troubling him, it really makes a profound difference. When the Spirit comes upon him, he is not in his right mind. When the Spirit is not upon him, he's not repentant, he's not regenerate, but he's not just absolutely out of his mind. He's able to think somewhat rationally. And so Jonathan appeals to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant David. He's not sinned against you. He has done good to you. God has used him to work great salvation for Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why do you want to kill David?" And so Saul listens to Jonathan. He allows himself to be entreated. He says, "You're right." By the way, this is going to happen again in chapter 24. Oh, it's going to happen again in chapter 26. And yet by that time, David is going to understand that you can't trust Saul as far as you could throw him. And yet David is willing to come back at this time. Jonathan calls him in, verse 7. Jonathan reports to him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. Some time passes. We don't know how long. There is war again. There is a campaign against the Philistines. David is involved in that, of course, but he's also back and forth. He's still serving Saul as a musician, and once again, a spear gets thrown. It's becoming increasingly difficult by now for David to deny that there is something going on, that there is an intentional plot by Saul to do him harm. And actually, Michal, his wife, picks up on this more quickly than her brother Jonathan does. Michal tells David, "You've got to get out of town, because otherwise he's going to kill you tonight." Now, this is one of the unfortunate episodes in David's life. But one of the things that you see is that Michal, David's wife, has a teraphim in the house, a household god. She has an idol, maybe multiple idols here. And she uses them to disguise the bed and to try and convince the soldiers that come to arrest David that he's actually in the bed sick. When they go back and report to Saul, Saul says, "I don't care, bring him in the bed. I'm going to kill him." And then you notice something else unfortunate about Michal. This is a foreshadowing of her later character that will be revealed. Verse 17, when Saul confronts her and says, "Why have you deceived me like this? Why have you let my enemy go? I mean, aren't you supposed to have a greater commitment to me as your father than to David as your husband?" I guess is the thinking. And what does she say? How does she justify this? She throws David under the bus completely, right? She says, "Well, he threatened me. I mean, you know how crazy that guy is. You know what a violent person he is. What was I supposed to do, Dad?" She saves her own life by lying about David. David goes to Samuel, right? Samuel is operating, for all intents and purposes, a little seminary, a school of the prophets. We'll see this continue to develop even after Samuel's life. Later in the divided kingdom, Elijah and Elisha are going to continue the same practice. That's a whole other conversation to have. But Samuel has a group of prophets that gather together, whether for training or for intercessory purposes, at Ramah, where he is based. And when Saul finds out that David is there, he sends men to arrest David. And wouldn't you know it, all of them are disabled by the Spirit. They all begin to prophesy. They don't prophesy because they're pious people. They don't prophesy because they have some sort of a gift. They prophesy because God is bringing judgment upon them. And then a second group is sent, and they prophesy. And a third group is sent, and they prophesy. And then Saul says, "Fine, I'll do it myself." Now, maybe he thinks that he is impervious to the influence of the Spirit. After all, the Spirit has been away from him for a very long time. Did you notice what happened? The Spirit of God came upon him also. This is in verse 23. And he went and he prophesied until he came to Naoth in Ramah. And then verse 24, what happened? He stripped off his clothes and he prophesied before Samuel and lay naked all that day and all that night. Thus it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? You remember that phrase from previously in chapter 10. This was one of the confirming signs that Saul had indeed been chosen by God for kingship. Now, the language here, by the way, even though the way that ESV translates it makes it sound like he is completely naked, and maybe he was, but there's no reason to necessarily think that from the Hebrew. This would be stripping out his outer garment again. But what does this remind you of? It should be two things. What did we say back in chapter 18? What does Jonathan do? He takes off his garment. He takes off his robe. He takes off all of the signs and symbols of his office and his position, and he gives them to David. Saul goes to kill David. And what does God do? He puts him on the ground naked, and his clothes are given to David. Do you see that? The second thing it needs to make you think of is back all the way back in chapter 5. Remember what happened in chapter 5? The Philistines have captured the Ark of the Covenant and they put it in the house of their God. This is their trophy. This is the sign of their victory. That's what Saul is seeking, right? He wants a trophy. He wants a sign of his victory. He wants to take David and kill David so that David cannot take the throne. And what happens when the Ark of the Covenant is put in the temple of Dagon? Remember, the Philistines come in the first morning and they find that Dagon is bowing down to the Ark of Yahweh. They say, "Well, that's a weird coincidence. Let's set him back up and make sure that doesn't happen again." The next day they come in, he's bowed down again, but now his head and his hands are broken off. You know what God just did? He toppled over Saul and he broke him. He broke him. And it is a clear sign that God has chosen David. If you think Saul was afraid of David before, you've not seen anything yet. This is now going to begin David's fugitive period.